Hi, Chris.
Hey there, Brink. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Let's introduce ourselves. I'm Brink Lindsay from the Cato Institute.
And I'm Chris Hayes. I'm the Washington editor of The Nation magazine.
And you've just written a paper for New America Foundation on Whip Up Inflation Now.
That's right. Yeah, it's a little play on the whip inflation now phrase of the 1970s, made famous by the win buttons during the Ford administration.
Yeah,
the last line in my paper is inflation now.
Yeah, that's an illusion that will go over the heads of people that are your age and younger. But I remember it. I remember win buttons, and I remember as a teenager thinking they were lame. I knew even then.
Yeah, I even lefty that I am, and skeptical of a lot of the frameworks of the general sort of theory of the world embodied in neoclassical economics. I think that moral suasion is probably not the best policy for reducing the price level.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit about your paper.
Yeah, so it's my first policy paper, which is kind of a funny thing to write because usually I write, for general audiences, but I've been doing some work. I'm a fellow in New America, and basically I'm making a case that actually has been made by a lot of people across the political spectrum. You have people like Ken Rogoff, who used to be at the IMF, is at Harvard now. He's not really lefty in any sense.
No.
Greg Mankiw, who was a Bush administration economic advisor.
Yeah.
A bunch of other people. A guy named George Cooper wrote a great book that I recommend to people called All the Origins of Financial Crisis. It's a very slim book that sort of traces it. The idea is this. We have this massive, massive amount of, a debt overhang. The total household, total debt, all sectors, including, so household, corporate, public sector debt together is about 400% of GDP. And, I quote Ken Rogoff saying, basically, how do you get out from under this debt boulder? The problem is, you need credit to fuel productivity and expansion. But when you have too much credit, you have a sort of explosion like we've had. You have this very autocatalytic deleveraging process.
Yeah.
And everybody ends up taking out their money to service their debt. And the money service debt is money that's not going to, the kinds of things that we want. Productive enterprise.
Productive investment, right.
Right, so the perfect example, right, is like the household that says they can't send their kids to college because they have to cover, medical bills and a second mortgage and credit card bills, et cetera, right? So that's definitely not what you want. So the question is, well, how do you get out from under this, from under this debt overhang? And one solution is mass bankruptcy.
Yes.
Which imposes a lot of intense legal costs, and even from, I think, a libertarian perspective is less than ideal because there's going to be a lot of transaction costs. One is just to kind of let it be and basically tolerate what I think is going to be really low growth for a long time.
Right.
And the third option is to essentially attempt to get a moderate, sustained level of inflation that will eat away at the real value of the debt overhang. So that's the argument in short form.
So that we need at least a dose of inflation for a while to avoid being crushed by the debt burden and to facilitate the deleveraging process in a way that,
that
is consistent with decent economic performance.
That's exactly it. And I made this sort of metaphor when I was speaking in New America. I mean, I think you'll be shocked to hear this, Brink, but it turns out people on the internet are not really crazy about people that make the case for inflation.
Yeah.
Particularly libertarians. This is not a big. Although Reason Magazine ran this forum in which they ran some people saying that this was a good idea. So, but the point I made at New America was that. I likened it to, when a baseball hitter is in the on-deck circle,
mm-hmm.
and they have, like, the donut on the bat.
Right.
Right, to artificially sort of make the bat feel heavier, and they take it off, and they can swing freely at the plate. So
yep.
To me, like, the deflationary pressures right now and the debt overhang
Yes.
On the bat, and getting some sort of moderate inflation would remove the donut. So it's sort of,
right.
I think, necessary for growth, but it's not the engine of it, right? Like, I don't think this is, like, the thing that creates prosperity.
Gotcha. Well, let me give you a few reactions. Let me start off with a declaration that I should make always, which is that when discussing macroeconomics, I want to declare up front a kind of deep epistemological humility. I'm not certain about anything these days. A lot of what I thought I knew was confounded by recent events, and then trying to learn about recent events, I've read a whole bunch over the past year or so, and I've read a whole bunch of things by a range of different people, all of whom have much greater technical expertise in dealing with these subjects than I do, all of whom spend their professional careers thinking about these subjects, and who are all over the map about these
yes.
subjects. And so, therefore,
I
find myself, I'm still at that kind of in that grim place where the more I learn about what's been happening, the less I feel I know.
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah.
So, that said, I'm sympathetic to your argument, at least in terms of the short term. Indeed, we're running this month at the Cato web magazine, Cato Unbound. We're running an issue about what is to be done about the economy, and the lead essayist is an economist and blogger, economist at Bentley, Scott Sumner, who also blogs at an excellent and interesting blog called The Money Illusion. And
I read that piece.
He indeed is arguing along similar lines, not the same as what you're saying, but he is still arguing that he argues that we went into the tank in the fall of last year because the Fed was actually pursuing too contractionary a monetary
yes.
policy, which is completely at odds with what most people think. They think it
yep.
was extravagantly easy money policy. But he has an very interesting and I think plausible, if not correct, argument that he's right. And he advocates targeting a kind of constant nominal GDP growth by the Fed. He thinks
right.
that we have been too inflation hawkish and that
yep.
At a time where real growth is going to be pretty anemic, then targeting a steady level of, say, 5% nominal GDP growth is going to build in a decent amount of inflation. So there are, and he is on the libertarian side of the political spectrum, and he's pushing in the same direction as well. I think there's, you mentioned bankruptcy as a kind of alternative to inflation, and I think there's an interesting analogy between the two. Both of them point to the utility of debt forgiveness.
Yes.
as a way to keep economic dynamism churning along.
That's right.
Once upon a time, a kind of more classically libertarian property rights uberalis approach to debt was that once you contracted a debt, you paid it off, and if you couldn't pay it
right.
off, you spent the rest of your life paying it off, and maybe we'll put you in a debtor's
right.
prison
right.
to keep you focused on the task. It became generally realized that sort of absolute protection of creditors' interests was inconsistent with the overall interest in economic growth, and so we developed bankruptcy laws that let debtors off the hook and let them make a clean
right.
start,
right.
and that give creditors the so-called haircut.
Right.
So. One could see a period of temporary inflation as a kind of just massive macro bankruptcy proceeding where you're letting debtors
right.
generally off the hook, because
right.
that's what inflation does. It favors debtors over creditors.
Right, and I will say that my inbox, just to interject for a second, first of all, the Sumner
yep.
piece I would really recommend, I think, is great, and I don't agree with it, but it's very funny, right, because we're from very different parts of the political spectrum and kind of end up converging in – in this place, and there's sort of some interesting sociology of the politics of this issue that to discuss around this, right? Because what's interesting about the Sumner piece is that he's reprising the argument made by Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz in their Monetary History of the U.S., where they basically say, look, everyone looks at the Great Depression and says this is the great condemnation of a certain kind of free market capitalism that exists in the 20s. It's a market failure, and that's, I think, was the dominant way that economists and certainly the general public viewed it. And Friedman and Schwartz sort of came up with this theory in which they said, no, actually, it was government failure. The Fed failed to expand the monetary supply to deal with all the bank closures, and that actually was the cause of the misery, and so don't lay this at the feet of capitalism. This is actually a government failure. And everybody says now, you know, Bernanke has learned the lesson of, you know, he's a student of the Great Depression, and all these very interesting and novel things he's doing at the Fed vis-a-vis quantitative easing and the Fed balance sheet and expanding the money supply, you know, tremendously in all sorts of ways, shows that he's read his Friedman and Schwartz, and Sumner comes along and says, actually, we're doing the same thing again, and that the money supply has not been expanded nearly enough, and that's what's causing the problem. And once again, don't lay this at the feet of free market capitalism. This is once again a sort of government failure, so it has this kind of interesting ideological valence underneath it, sort of. So anyway, I just thought it was a really interesting piece for that reason.
Yeah, and then both times, according to Sumner's analysis, at the time you had the defenders of the free market in the 30s being, you know, incredible inflation hawks. And unwittingly, therefore, contributing to the economic meltdown that then made the New Deal and more generally around
That's
the world
right.
the shift
That's
towards,
right.
you know, more... State-dominated state forms of economic policy possible, and he's worried that that's happening again. So I've been reading Scott for a while, and I think he's really interesting and really smart. Again, my declaration of humility means I don't know what's going on, and so we just thought it would be a good idea to, because there's people who violently disagree with him, especially in our libertarian ranks. So we thought it would be good to set him up against three other smart people and see if they can pick them apart.
I've yet to read the responses, but I would endorse people reading that. And if you read my paper, we'll post them obviously in Blogging Heads. We'll post that paper in my paper, we can probably post a link to the reason for them. It's an interesting. It's one of these things that doesn't. It's hard to get a lot of traction around in terms of mainstream discussion, but it's the kind of thing that. Particularly experts and monetary economists and people who are going to central bank, you know, conferences, it's sort of all they're thinking about and worrying about.
Right. Let me just pick something to disagree with you about in your paper.
Please do.
Most of your paper is about making the case for a temporary burst of inflation to get out from under the rock. And that, I think, is a plausible argument. Then sort of woven in there from time to time is a kind of a sense that maybe inflation all the time is a good thing, or pouring cold water on the accomplishment of the great disinflation of the past quarter century.
Yes.
And there I'll part company with you. I think that some kind of basic price stability is a really, really good thing. It makes investment long-range planning possible in a way that that is really gummed up by inflation, in significant part because inflation is not a smooth, across-the-board phenomenon, as you might think from discussions of the price level. Relative prices are moving all over the place, so being able to calculate over the long term, I think, in any kind of intelligible way, gets really hard under conditions of inflation. So I think it's a big deterrent to productive investment if it's a ongoing chronic problem. You make it sound as if the disinflation that occurred in the United States is a sort of a specifically American phenomenon that's associated with the rise of conservatism and what you call the upward redistribution of wealth, and then the excesses of the financial sector in recent years. But the fact is, disinflation is a completely global phenomenon over the past generation. It occurred everywhere. Advanced countries across the board saw declining inflation rates. Developing countries across the board saw incredibly declining inflation rates. You know, triple, quadruple digit inflation were common in developing countries. Brazil was insane during the 70s and 80s. Mexico was often had triple digit inflation. It was commonplace around the world, and what that often did, because it was in conjunction with controlled interest rates, you had negative real interest rates in much of the developing world, which then really retarded the development of financial sectors and therefore of economic development. So I would say that generally the global phenomenon of disinflation has had, since it's a global phenomenon, it has had global causes. Part of it is a recognition by elite policymakers that inflation's bad for business, and since elites can change monetary policy, they have.
That's right.
And part of it, though, I think, and here I'll refer to a very interesting article published a couple of years ago in the Cato Journal by Randy Krosner. It argues that globalization and financial deregulation are a major contributor to global disinflation, because people can take their money out of local currencies when the value of it starts being inflated away, and that in turn reduces a lot of the bang for the buck that governments used to get from inflating their currency to pay off their debts. I will put all of that as a package that's, it's a bigger phenomenon than U.S. politics, and then beyond that, I'll say it's a good thing.
Yeah, so I guess I'd say a few things. One is that I wouldn't ever want anyone to think that I was making the case for, you know, triple-digit inflation or think that's a good place. I mean, I think that's obviously a bad thing for all the reasons you mentioned. And second of all, in terms of the global phenomenon being a global phenomenon, absolutely right. The global phenomenon was largely due to, like you said, elite policymakers both within countries and also the structural adjustment programs of the IMF to their countries that created incredibly strong central banks. I mean, if you look at the sort of the post-apartheid constitution in South Africa, you basically have a intensely socialistic and social democratic constitutional system with a German-style European central bank.
Yes.
And the central bank tends to sort of win in that battle, and that's true in a lot of places in the developing world. And I would also say that to a point, central bank independence is important. Mm-hmm. I think it's oversold. I think it needs democratic accountability probably more than you do, and more than I think a lot of my friends on the right think. But certainly, I don't think it's the case that, you know, you don't want to be Zimbabwe. This is sort of stipulated. So, but I do think, now getting into the U.S. case, I think there's an interesting thing to say here, and Mankiw actually made this point. So we have somewhere around 2%. I mean, we don't have formal inflation targeting, right? We have, like, informal inflation targeting. We're somewhere around 2.5% per year. So the question is why?
Yes.
Why is that defensible and 4.5 isn't, right?
Right.
Now, one argument to that, which I understand, right, is a slippery slope argument, right, which is that you basically push as low as you can. It's the nature of a modern industrial economy. There's going to be some increase in the price level. And so, you basically push as low as you can, and what you get is around 2 and 2.5%. And if you try to nudge that up, you get the slippery slope, right? So that 4 becomes 6, 6 becomes 8, 8 becomes 15, and you have – now, that argument is based on the experience of the 70s, in which I think central banks, particularly the United States, the Federal Reserve, didn't have the credibility it does now as an extinguisher of inflation, right?
Yeah.
If you take away the slippery slope argument, which is actually kind of it's a hard argument to resolve, right? It's sort of an empirical argument about the future, right? We just don't know.
Yeah.
Then the question of why 4 or 5 is not defensible and 2 is, I think, becomes a harder one to sort out. And my point is that, A, there's this technical reason, right, which is that if you have a little higher inflation rate, you produce more downward latitude for the Fed in monetary policy.
Yeah.
Which is a point Jessica Yellen, Fed governor in San Francisco, recently made at a talk. But also, I mean, you know, there is a sort of there's this Phillips curve question, which is, you know, if you have an economy that has a strong, in which labor has strong bargaining power, which we don't have right now,
right.
In which you're having broad median wage gains, that's going to put some upward pressure on prices, and you know, and one in which disinflation is not being exported from China in the way that it is now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sort of thinking about what an economy as a package. You know, you just talked about the sort of package of disinflation. I'm sort of thinking about, like, what an economy, a sort of more broadly prosperous economy, a less unequal economy, a less financialized economy in the future going forward looks like. And it's hard for me to imagine that economy that doesn't have a little more inflation.
Interesting point. I think that, first, one reason for a 2% target is a recognition of the very likely overestimation of inflation that our measures provide.
Right. 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 Yep.
Of course, there's an attempt. There have been attempts to adjust the consumer price index and other price indexes for quality improvements.
Mm-hmm.
But those attempts are always, I think, a day late and a dollar short. Things don't show up in the consumer price index until they've become sort of mass products, by which time they've particularly if we're talking about electronics kind of goods, they've already engaged, you know, they've already undergone just plummeting price levels. And quality improvements, I think, are hard to factor into adjustments for inflation. And so I think there's a sense by central bankers that 2% is probably pretty close to real-world price stability. So I think that makes some sense. If you really do start having real inflation, then perhaps real inflationary expectations do start to set in and become hard to reverse, and you get on that slippery slope. It is absolutely true, and I think it's an interesting kind of jujitsu move that you're making, that we understand inflation a lot better now than we did during the great inflation of the 60s and 70s. I lived through that period, and I've read about that period, but I remember at the time it was just people who argued that inflation was basically a monetary phenomenon were in the minority, and they were hooted down, and the conventional opinion at the time was that that it was just some kind of basic disease of democracies, put aside the fact that plenty of autocracies had inflation too, but that the Phillips curve and the push to keep unemployment low just guaranteed that we were going to have inflation, and the only real way to deal with it was through incomes policy or ultimately through price controls. That was very much of a standard point of view, and even the prevailing point of view in academic economic circles, and certainly in political circles, and all of that's just gone out the window now. We know now that central bankers can control inflation if they want to, and so perhaps, and here's the jiu-jitsu move, now that we understand it better, then perhaps we don't have to be so paranoid about it. Perhaps we can let off the brakes a little bit because we know exactly how to tap them again. The problem is that as they say, the money supply is connected to inflation with long and variable lags, and so by the time you see what is, you do something that looks moderate, and then some time later it translates into an inflation rate much higher than you were expecting, and inflationary expectations have sort of grabbed hold, and then to stop the party, you've got to throw the economy into a recession, and that's bad. So, I will remain skeptical that a moderate, stable amount of inflation is a good thing for the long term.
Well, let's talk about. I mean, let's pivot off that and talk about the bailout and the Fed more broadly, because
stay in economic wonk mode.
What's that?
We'll stay in economic wonk mode. If we haven't bored the viewers to tears by a long discussion of inflation, we can get them with bailout mania.
Yeah, I think that's a little sexier. So I'm actually working on a piece with Noe Prinz. We're co-writing a piece for next week's issue about the bailout. And I actually think this is a place I think we'll likely see eye to eye in certain ways. I mean, the thing. I think the thing to me that I that has been so interesting about going through this is, A, that I think there's a broad misconception that the bailout consists of the $700 billion that was authorized in the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, otherwise known as the TARP.
Yep.
And that once the banks, like, say, Goldman, which has paid back their TARP portion, right, they've repurchased the shares, that, you know, they're kind of no longer on the dole, as it were.
Yes.
But, you know, the fact of the matter is that TARP is a tiny percentage of the full facilities that have been used to bail out the banking sector. And the thing that the biggest thing is that in a billion different ways, I mean, not literally a billion, but in a lot of different ways, actually about five or six different ways, chiefly the Fed, but also the Treasury and sometimes the FDIC have provided to the banks what amounts to very cheap credit.
Yes.
And all a bank does is lend for more money than it borrows.
Right. And not just cheap credit, but no questions asked credit. Like, we don't care if you're a credit worthy credit. Right.
Literally. Yeah. I mean, so the way that our piece works is that we create a fictional couple named Joe and Katie who live in a Minneapolis suburb, and we posit what, you know, they have this totally screwed up balance sheet and their business is in trouble and they're unemployed and they're facing bankruptcy and they have all these gambling debts, yada, yada. And we step through the different ways that sort of Fed has helped the banks as if they were helping this household, right?
Yep.
So things like, you know, posting their old baseball card collection as collateral. Yes. You know, getting a loan, getting a guarantee on the price of their vacation condo. So if it dips below its high point sale price, you know, the bailout bank makes up the difference. So all this, the point is that the thing, I mean, this is a sort of obvious point, but it hasn't really struck me until really looking at it, is that all banks do is borrow for less than they lend at. So yes. If you give them no question asked free money, it's very easy to make a huge profit.
Yeah.
You know, it would be like if you were a cabinet maker and the Federal Reserve said, we're going to give you all the wood for free.
Right.
Like, that's just what your input is, right,
yes,
as for your business. Like,
right.
And so no wonder we're seeing record profits and bonuses for the banks now because this, you know, even someone said, I think it was actually a conservative. I think it might have been someone like, who is it? That wasn't Donald Luskin. So someone on CNBC said even a banker could make money under these conditions.
Yeah. Yes. And so there's that, and then there's the fact that there has been this massive consolidation,
and
a number of players have been more or less wiped out, which means that just with reduced competition, there's been prospect for these whopping trading profits that we're seeing by the investment banks. So yes.
And what I think here, I mean, I think there's a sort of interesting thing to think about here, and I think that I'll be – we'll have different – so I was talking to a friend of mine yesterday who's works at a hedge fund, and we were talking about this. And I think there's a kind of – I think most people say – I don't know, generally, even the bailouts are incredibly unpopular, right? People say this is lemon socialism, this is unfair. You know, for me, it's like the thing that really – angers me, actually, genuinely enrages me, is that I would be willing to swallow it all if foreclosures hadn't just hit an all-time peak.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know what I mean? It's like, I think most people, and I think particularly on the right, it's like they kind of want austerity for everyone.
Yes.
And I kind of want, like, bailouts for everyone.
Right.
It's like, I would be, you know what I mean? It's like, I would be willing to trade this fire hose of cheap money into the pockets of Goldman if the Fed were essentially, you know, doing the same for if there were wide scale principal write downs for people that are, you know, in the Detroit suburbs with, you know, houses that were $300,000 and now $200,000.
Right.
And the fact that that's not happening, the fact that you have unemployment so high and you have people that are, and the fact that we've made personal bankruptcy harder amidst all this, that to me is like the thing that I can't abide.
Yeah.
So that's my rant.
I'll distinguish between bailouts in principle and bailouts as executed. Taking the former first. Again, I'll start with my declaration of humility. But my sense is I have real sympathy for the analysis that the bank failures of 29 to 32 were a really the critical element in the collapse mm-hmm. of the American and then the world economy, and that the standing by and letting that happen was just a catastrophe of the first magnitude. And so I understand Bernanke, who's a student of that particular debacle, not wanting to repeat that error, and seeing what looked like a classic bank run, not on depository right. institutions, but a creditor's bank run on the whole shadow banking system. We thought we had cured bank runs with deposit insurance, but here we had a different kind of bank run going on.
Right, yes.
For understandable reasons, wanted to stop it and wanted to be the lender of last resort that kept the financial sector from wholesale collapse. So I get that idea. And I have some sympathy for the idea that some bailouts of some financial institutions were necessary. Whether the way we went about it, though, seems indiscriminate and also panicky. You're right, of course, that before TARP happened, the Fed had been expanding its balance sheet in an incredibly aggressive way, and really TARP came to pass because the Fed said, no mas, and now it's time for Treasury to step up and get and do this through fiscal policy rather than through this, we're making it up as we go along, monetary policy. But then the way that was presented, I think, may very well have contributed to the worsening of the crisis. That press conference where a ashen and panicky looking Paulson and Bernanke stood side by side and said, more or less, the world is coming to an end. Give us $700 billion, no questions asked. Here are three sheets of paper that explain why and what we're doing with it. And by the way, we don't want any congressional or judicial oversight of what we're doing. If markets weren't freaked out enough already, I just can't imagine that didn't send them around the bend. And in fact, there was a piece in the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago by I guess it was John Cochran of Chicago and, mm-hmm. and Luigi Zingales of Chicago arguing that the TARP rollout was a major contributor to the to the worsening of the crisis in the last fall. So that panicky kind of way of proceeding, and then it turned out that they said we're going to use this to buy toxic assets, and then it turned out they weren't. They were going to use it to do equity infusions, and then they changed their mind and they set up this new kind of public-private investment program. It just smacked of no one having any idea what they were doing. That had to spread panic as well. Then the idea that you couldn't figure out which institutions were pretty solid. You couldn't do any kind of triage. You couldn't say, these guys are goners. We're going to put them into the FDIC's hands or into some kind of expedited bankruptcy hands and be done with them. These guys are doing fine, and these other guys are in between. The fact they couldn't do any triage at all struck me as not the right approach. So I have lots of things that I feel confident about criticizing the way they went about things. As to whether in principle bailouts of any kind of financial institutions were a bad idea, that I think is probably not true.
Yeah, no, I'm definitely not in the like sort of let it burn, we should have done nothing camp. I think there are people on both the right and the left who are in that camp. And I have a lot of respect for that view too, but I do think some sort of infusions. To me, the hilarious ironies of this, actually a very funny irony, is that we wrote a piece around the time of the bailout where we basically said we should really be doing this through the Fed, which is exactly what happened. The Fed was expanding their balance sheet. They said enough. They went through the fiscal policy. They went through Congress. and got smacked around. They didn't like getting beaten up. Obviously, the first attempt doesn't pass. And basically, since then, we've just gone back to doing it through the Fed. So it's really funny. I mean, you know, when you go back and look at, like, right now I was looking at, like, no one's using this. You know, there's this huge rollout about the PPIP, the Public-Private Investment Partnership, and that was going to be the thing where we, you know, and there was op-eds about it. And, well, no one's using it. Why is no one using it? Why would you go into this thing where you could possibly lose money when you could just keep getting cheap money from the Fed and making money? Like, And the concern I have, and it's a real genuine concern politically, is that people hate the bailouts. They hate them. They have every right to hate them. The bailouts are confused with the stimulus.
Yep.
They are – I mean, I talked to people who were at the 9/12 march. I saw people on video. Number one thing when you say to people – the other thing that I think conservatives really, really hate is the GM takeover. But I think that's a more limited thing, right? I think that's more of a – you know, people that are sort of already kind of predisposed to a skepticism towards state action and libertarianism. I think that's a little more ideologically confined, whereas I think anger about the bailouts is just like a real, but you know, it's the sort of thing that, like, it's like talking about the weather, right? Like, you can pull up to a truck stop or a diner or a Little League baseball game anywhere in the country and start a discussion about how much the bailouts suck, and that, you know, that that's going to go fine.
Because it's just, I mean, as a morality play, it's no crowd pleaser, right? Everybody's hurting. Little guys are hurting. And the sort of, you know, most insanely wealthy folks and the people who are responsible for all this are getting special accommodations. That's just whether there is a good consequentialist case for doing some of that or not, just
that's
as a morality play, it just
It
just can't help but elicit boos and hisses and tomatoes.
And here's the thing to me that's really so dangerous for the Obama administration, for the Democratic Party, is that you're going to have record bonuses, you have record profits. That is by design. Let's just be clear, right? The way that the current way that this is, they're going to fix their balance sheet is to recapitalize through profits, right?
Yeah.
We are going to give the banks cheap money and let them make a ton off it until they can restore their balance sheet's order. So by design, there's going to be lots of profits, lots of bonuses. Meanwhile, unemployment is going to hover around 10%.
Right.
Credit continues to decline. I mean, the latest credit figures, which were out yesterday, continue to decline. And of course, the reason is that when you're getting, you know, you don't have to – you know, when you're making a lot of money from all this cheap money on the input side, you don't have to do a ton of lending, right?
Right.
And plus,
they're trying to build up their balance sheets again so that they feel comfortable about expanding.
That's right. Right. Credit. Exactly. That's the whole strategy. I'm not even saying, you know, the banks are being bad guys in some moral sense, right? I'm just saying, like, this is the way the incentive structure has been created.
Yeah.
Right. And so by design, it seems to me you're just going to have a situation in which the financial sector and the banks look like they're doing great. Meanwhile, unemployment's very high. There's a lot of foreclosure. People see homes that are empty in their neighborhood, etc. And this to me seems like a real recipe for total political disaster, blowback, and ass whooping in the midterms.
Well, that's a good segue then to what we were going to talk about next, I think, which is how Obama and the touted progressive realignment are doing. You know, everybody talks about the analogies between now and the 30s, and of course the 30s had an economic cataclysm that then led to a huge political sea change, and in particular the New Deal and a rethink of the role of the government in economic life. It looked like something like that was happening again, that we had this worst economic blowout since the Great Depression occurring, and then sweeping into power large Democratic majorities in both houses and a charismatic transformative kind of figure as president, who was sort of more unapologetically, in fact, the first unapologetically progressive left of center guy to win the presidency in 40 years. We had mm-hmm. two Democrats win before, Carter and Clinton since 68, but both of them ran away from liberalism and presented themselves as non-ideological centrists, emphasized their social conservatism as well. Here was an unapologetic left of center man sweeping into the White House in bad times, and so if we were going to, if indeed these times kind of rhymed across the board with the 30s, we were expecting this big shift to the left, and you had Rahm Emanuel saying we can't let a good crisis go to waste, and you had the rollout of the agenda in early 2009 that looked like that Obama wasn't going to be a pick and choose kind of moderate. He was going to mm-hmm. roll out the full Democratic wish list that had been accumulating for many years. And then they hit a big mud bog.
Yeah.
Now, you know, first card check, the legislation to try to build back the union movement. That suffered early reverses and kind of got taken off the table at the beginning, although it's still floating around and may come back, although probably with the elimination of the secret ballot, with the card check element taken out of it.
Mm-hmm.
Then we've had all kinds of problems with cap and trade legislation getting through, and something limped through Congress, but it was is a real mess of a bill from a purist green point of view as well as from mm-hmm. my point of view. Mm-hmm. And prospects in the Senate are uncertain to dim. Mm-hmm. Healthcare, of course, has flared up with all these town hall meetings and real problems assembling a workable majority in both houses for anything. And so the question is, was there just too much hype? About the meaning of this election, or did progressives just engage in wishful thinking, or are things really proceeding according to plan, but politics is always an ugly slog, and we're just going to have to slog it through and check back in a couple of years, and you'll see that the realignment is indeed underway,
yeah.
Or what? Did Obama blow it? Did he have bad tactics? What's your read as a probably not, somewhat less optimistic and exuberant progressive now than you were 6 months ago?
Yeah, I mean, I think I had a generally decent sense of how tough a slog it was going to be. I mean, I think a few things. One is, I always thought the 32 comparisons were overblown because there's a huge difference between 23% unemployment and in a country with essentially no welfare state.
Right.
In which people are by the thousands, by the tens of thousands, starving to death in the streets.
Right.
I mean,
and not just no welfare state, but just a country that was, you know, a poor third world country by early 21st century comparisons. There was just there was no buffer there between, much less of a buffer between, you know, outright privation and good times.
Right.
So
that's exactly
very different times.
I mean, there was genuine physical desperation, right?
Yeah.
Like, and which is not to say that there isn't tremendous misery now, and there are people, and there are food banks have been reporting record amounts of food dispersed and things like that.
Yeah.
But in an absolute level, the absolute privation is very different. There's a huge difference between 10% and 22%.
Yep.
The congressional majorities that Roosevelt had were insane. I mean, I was just moving around trying to find it, but I mean, you know, I forget how many. I mean, he makes today's majorities look razor thin. So he just had this huge, you know.
Yeah.
So I always thought they were overblown. So why are things sort of stymied or slowed? Okay, so I think we should sort of disaggregate a bunch of stuff, okay? So let's start with public opinion. You know, America's a conservative country by the standards of sort of what we call Western democracies, I think you'd agree, and that actually extends in an interesting way to New Zealand, Australia, Canada, and England are, even though I think we're probably to the right of all those, I mean, it's an oversimplification to put countries in a left-right spectrum, but you know, so part of that, I think, is the legal institutions that grew up out of sort of the English tradition tend to be more conservative,
mm-hmm.
More hostile to change, harder to change things. The political culture, I think, tends to be more conservative. And America has this whole other, you know, exceptionalism. It's race and slavery places. So there is this kind of deep tradition, right? And now I think, you know, a lot of the kind of Tea Party stuff it's really just not new at all. I mean, this
right.
is just, you know, the things that they're saying about Obama, the Liberty League was saying about Roosevelt.
Yes.
And, I mean, almost word for word, actually. And sort of, in fact, it's fascinatingly retro, I have to say.
Same things they were saying about Kennedy. There's a fun little article that doesn't have anything to do with public policy that I read in Vanity, the most recent issue of Vanity Fair, about William Manchester's book, The Death of a President. He was a huge
right.
Kennedy fan. He was called by the Kennedy family to write the definitive account of the assassination. And then he got in a huge legal wrangle with Jackie about actually getting it published. And so it's just an account of that. But along the way, there's little details in that article about the kind of climate in Dallas at that time. And man, it just sounded just like stuff going on right now, of just crazy conspiracy theories about Kennedy selling out to the communists, et cetera. So that kind of just hardcore, hatred of liberal elites in power is an ongoing phenomenon in American life.
Right, and I think that. So I think when people say, well, it's sort of crashed on the shoals of public opinion, or people are, you know, wary of big government, or I just don't think that's particularly true. I think public opinion and approval for the president and Congress have declined because the economy sucks and continues to suck. and there is some part of the mindset of your sort of typical independent that is quote unquote worried about deficits or,
yeah.
But those are not, I don't think those are dispositive. You know what I mean? Like, I think there's a huge confusion between depth of sentiment and breadth of that sentiment vis-a-vis, you know, the Tea Party or 9/12 group. I mean, like I said the other night on TV that, you know, 60 million people voted against Barack Obama. You know, some percentage of those people really, 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 really hate the Democratic Party, hate the liberal elites, hate Barack Obama, hate anything that, quote-unquote, smacks of socialism. You know what I mean? Like, And I think that they've gotten very organized, to their tactical credit, and networked and organized, and they have a network, a cable news network that gives them quite a platform. So I think the real obstacles are much more obstacles to political economy, and this is a place in which I'm becoming kind of a lefty public choicer, as it were. You know, I just think that Washington is incredibly corrupt and very captured by a lot of big corporate interests. And I'm not quite sure how to crack that shell, but that's,
right.
I think, you know, in the case of the House climate change bill, I mean, when you're done bribing everyone.
Yes.
Right? What do you have left? I mean, that's the problem, right? The model that we have for legislation is we bribe the opponents of it. Or the people who the corporate, particularly the large business interests that stand in its way or find it a threat to their bottom line, we get the legislation passed such as it is by bribing them. But the problem is that often that bribery A makes it much more expensive and B vitiates the purpose. In the case of cap and trade, vitiates a lot of the purpose of the legislation. Let me just say, finally, I think there's this procedural thing, which is that the filibuster is a horrible institution and, you know, needs to be scrapped. So that's my short answer to the stymieing.
Yeah, on the bribery point, I think we're about to we're really just starting to see that process unfold on healthcare. I think there are some progressives who are breathing a sigh of relief that you got through the worst of it, maybe, the town hall explosion and all the bad PR and the Obama team looking like it was sort of wobbly and out of control, that maybe things have stabilized. He gave a good speech. Poll numbers have gotten a bit of a bounce. Maybe now it's time to the worst is over and you can get down to business and get something done. But I think you're right that a lot of the problems are not, you know, kind of outside agitation. It's the inside game that's really problematic, and there are just a whole host of vested interests that are encrusted around the healthcare status quo, and they're going to demand their payoff. Meanwhile, then there is just a large special interest constituency that isn't it's not a corporate special interest. It's senior citizens, they are incredibly well engaged in the political process, and they are incredibly zealous in protection of their narrow interests. And they smell something in this reform that means less for them than otherwise would be the case. And that is going to be a terrifically difficult obstacle to overcome. The way to overcome it and pass a bill is to give up on cost control, but then you've produced a really, really bad bill. I think the agonies of bright-eyed idealistic progressive reformers are not over. They're just beginning, I'm afraid, on health care. Let me just say I agree with you. I don't see in the Tea Party movement and the protests over the weekend, which were impressive. I was really shocked that so many people were out there. Indicate any kind of big, consistent philosophical objection to big government. You know, keep your government hands off my Medicare is not really Ayn Rand. Redux. But there's certainly an aversion to the other guys in getting in power and spending a lot of money. And so there's just the opposition to Obama is energized, and the support for Obama is currently sort of internally divided. And that's a recipe for trouble for Obama and his team. And then, as you just mentioned, the constellation of interests that all have a say in how legislation is produced makes it very, very difficult for anything big to ever happen. I think what's going on in healthcare is very much the mirror image of what went on with Social Security 4 years ago. Again, senior citizens being the big reform-blocking constituency. Then that leaves, I think we're in the midst of what could be a real educational process, and at the end of it, people across the political spectrum, really grasp this public choice dynamic that politics is a really ugly and kind of deranged business, and so what can be done to make the country a better place with the political process we have? That may lead into new and interesting directions.
I think I'm a descriptive public choicer and not a metaphysical one, which is to say, I think that there's an incredibly corrupt complex, and I also think things could be better and have been better at different times and can be better in different ways. The way that I part and the reason that I end up on the political left and not on the political right in terms of that is that I think that that there are reforms, that we've had reforms to make things work better in the past, and I think we can and should in the future. But I do think that I think the country is suffering just a tremendous degree of, aside from just sort of there's the material misery of people losing jobs or the psychological taxation of the anxiety you're going to lose your job, the country's just suffering a pretty intense period, I feel like, of disillusionment, and Obama was the vessel, was sort of the antidote for that, very deftly, because he's a very talented communicator, and for a lot of reasons became the kind of vessel for sort of hope. But ultimately, I never thought it was the case that he was, the solution to it.
Right.
And, you know, one of the things I find that's very funny is I was talking to a friend of mine who's sort of a fellow lefty, and we were talking about having conversations during August when we were in, you know, traveling around the country and outside of D.C., and I sound now like sort of caricature of, like, an inside-the-beltway person. But, you know, I am sort of that at this point. I spent so much time here. And but it was just really interesting because I found myself, like, sounding like this total reactionary. Because I was just constantly saying, I mean, people feel frustrated, like, why can't, and there's a legitimate frustration, like, why can't we get this done? Like, why can't we have a public outcome? Why can't we have these things? We won the election. We have these congressional majorities. And it tends to get focused among the base, and those are the people I'm talking to, on the sort of weakness of Obama. And I think there's a lot to that critique. I don't think that's a – I mean, I think he has been weak in certain ways. I think he has made tactical mistakes. But to me, that's about, you know, 20% of the issue.
Yeah.
I mean, if and that's a generous apportionment. So I end up sort of saying, well, look, you know, got the filibuster, and we have this stupid committee system we should get scrapped the way Newt Gingrich did in 94. And, you know, we have this unbelievable amount of corporate money sloshing through the Capitol, yada, yada. And it just sounds like it ends up perversely sounding like a defense of the status quo. When really, you know, my time in Washington has done nothing but radicalize me by the day.
So it's radicalized you, but what is to be done, right? So let me just back up and say, just as I don't see any kind of big, coherent, new, limited government right arising, likewise, I never interpreted the elections of 2006 and 2008 as some big ideological shift to the left by the country. I think George Bush was just a really bad president, and Republican rule in Congress had become really squalid. And on top of that, the economy went south, and so there was just a real overdetermined throw the bums out reaction. It was understandable that folks on the left would think our time has come and we've got a crisis atmosphere. Right. The situation is really fluid. We can push a lot of stuff through. But I think that it probably was a real strategic error to kind of line everything up at once and try to push things through on parallel tracks, because recognizing what a gridlocked mess our political process is, it was just impossible that all these things were going to go through. Most of them were going to get hung up one way or another, if for lack of agenda space, if for no other reason. And then that creates the impression of disarray and being a loser, and political capital diminishes, and then you get kind of a blowback against somebody for being ineffective. So I think probably Democrats in Congress and the Obama administration did overread or they overplayed their hand, and that is a significant contributor to the where things stand today. Whether that can be unwound and recovered from, time will tell. It's entirely possible.
I'm not sure if I agree with that. I mean, I think I definitely don't think that's the case. I mean, maybe there's some sort of broad, vague sense in the public about doing too much, quote unquote. I'm sure if someone's pulled that, and I wouldn't be surprised if it's over 50%. Doing too much, doing too little. But and it's true, there's just a limited bandwidth here. To me, it's more of an issue of, I guess I just think the time horizon for all this is going to be long. I mean, I tend to think that the wind is still at the backs of social democracy, and I think that part of the reason for that is demographics. Part of the reason is I actually think the objective solutions to a bunch of problems like climate change are very hard to conceive of without some kind of social democratic framework. And then finally, I think that, I tend to think of Obama like Nixon in this respect.
Ouch.
Just in this one respect, which is that Nixon perfected the sort of the conservative message that would carry through all the way to George W. Bush.
Yes.
But in office was, particularly on domestic policy, in office was very much captured by the sort of liberal consensus status quo.
Yes.
And the actual domestic revolution in public policy didn't come until 12 years later with Reagan.
Yep.
And I think Obama's in a similar place. I think he's pioneered something quite brilliant and lasting about messaging progressivism. But I think the sort of crony capitalist corrupt status quo of Washington has sort of captured the domestic agenda, and I think it's going to take time.
Your message to fellow progressives then is don't lose heart, wait till 2020.
Right. I mean, my message is keep working, and you know, the Weber quote about the slow boring of hard boards, which Iglesias quotes all the time, and I think is pretty right on. So that's my hopeful note, maybe to end this blogging heads on.
All right, I don't want to rain on that on your wishful thinking. So we'll end it there. We've been talking for an hour, and it's time for us to shut up. But I've very much enjoyed talking to you, and I hope we can do this again pretty soon.
Me too, Brink. Hope we can.
Right.
Be well.
All right, take care. Bye bye.